BAI.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
Hello, I'm David Rothenberg, and I'm the oldest person of any room I enter, unless Malachi McCord is already plopped down in the room. So the two of us are getting together to have a conversation. And if you want to eavesdrop on it, and we'll be departing some wisdom, it'll cost you $25. But all the money's going to this cockamamie station, WBAI, which you might have heard could use a dollar or two. Conversation with Malachi and David will be at the Commons, the performance space below WBAI's Crystal Studios at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. The gathering will be on Sunday, December 8th at 2 o'clock. For ticket reservations, email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Leave your phone number and I'll call you back. So once again, it's Sunday, December 8th. At 2 o'clock, 388 Atlantic Avenue, and you can email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York City. 99.5 on the FM dial, streaming around the world at WBAI.org. And right now we're broadcasting from the Lead-Lined Studio. But as David Rothenberg mentioned, we're about to take you to the Crystal Ballroom to hear Off the Hook. They're not here. No, they're down the hall in the new studio. And it is 8 p.m. I'm going to hit the little chromium switch here, and we should have Off the Hook. 8 p.m. I'm going to hit the little chromium switch here, and we should have Off the Hook.
Well, I don't know if we made it, but maybe we did. And if we did, welcome. It's Off the Hook in a brand new studio. Here we are. Wow, I can't believe it. We're actually in the brand new studio. This is Off the Hook, making the debut, the unofficial debut, by the way. We're just taking this out for a test run. The real debut is coming in a weekend or two, and it's going to be in all the papers. Yeah, it's going to be amazing. This is Emmanuel, joined tonight by Alex.
Good evening from the new studio.
Okay, that microphone works. Gila.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening from a shiny new mic.
And Kyle.
Hello.
Kyle, you're sitting right by the window.
Yeah, I'm watching traffic.
Tell us, describe the traffic, because we can never do this before. We can give traffic reports on Atlantic Avenue. If you're on Atlantic Avenue, they'll be of interest to you. But otherwise, they might not be. Go ahead.
Currently, the light out here on Bond and Atlantic is stopped. Oh, there's a garbage truck.
There's a garbage truck. Which way is it going? Is it heading east or west?
It's going east.
It's going east. Okay.
So it just turned.
Now, the light is currently red for Atlantic Avenue or green?
No, it just turned green.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we have people actually typing this up for late-breaking news. That's amazing. Okay. And traffic seems to be moving kind of well. I can see the traffic, too. It looks like cars are going back and forth. I see there are some stores open. Oh, look, there's a person walking down the street. This is amazing. This is so cool. Oh, yeah, we should be doing a radio show, too. But
if we were...
I love looking out the window.
No, I mean, if we were taking calls, we could probably take a call if someone said, hey, yeah, I'm down on the street. We could wave,
we could wave,
and
wave
do
back.
Do that whole thing, and it would probably get boring after a little bit. But yeah, it's
you know what listeners can do though? They can drive down Atlantic Avenue and lean on their car horn, and we won't hear it because this is a soundproof studio. Go ahead, try that.
We're in a room with like walls that go all the way up to the ceiling. This is incredible.
Yeah, I can see there's people arguing out in the hallway, and they really looks like they're shouting at full volume at each other, both at the same time. In fact, you're not going to hear what the other person's saying that way, but we can't hear them. We can't hear them at all because it's soundproof in here. Wow, this is awesome. So never again will we hear the copier machine go off in the middle of the show. We won't hear the elevator ding. We won't hear people saying goodnight as they leave for the day. Sometimes for over 10 minutes saying goodnight. I'm going to miss it. We might go back to that studio too. It's still there. But this is awesome. And this is all thanks to you listeners. Thanks to your support. Thanks for your positivity. We now have a brand new facility.
Yeah, this is really the culmination of so much work and so much effort and so much support from you, our listeners, who you are the ones who made this happen. I mean, you're the ones we have to thank because, like, we can broadcast from here. We can use this shiny new equipment. I mean, this microphone really is shiny. There's not a spot of tarnish on it. And we have you to thank. So thank you, everyone who's supported BAI in the past, everyone who's supporting BAI right now, everyone who's going to support BAI in the future. It's because of you.
If I witness a crime on the street, am I obligated to report it, or can I wait till after the show? Oh, they're just fooling around. No, never mind. Okay, but you know, you look out the window, you see all kinds of things. That,
yeah, it's really distracting, actually.
Yeah.
look what they're doing in that window.
What happens if I bring this up? Hold on.
Distracting, actually.
Oh, it's us. It's us in the past.
Look what they're doing in that window.
What happens? Okay, well, that's going to get very distracting. Forgive us, folks. It's like a new toy for us. I do notice my mic is kind of cutting in and out. Do you guys notice that?
We're hearing you.
Maybe
fine.
It's my headphones.
No, you sound fine.
Maybe it's me. I don't know. Alex, looks like you've got something you really want to share with us. Do you get that promotion? Is that what this is about?
I have been up to some interesting things, but I'm not going to talk about that on the radio just yet.
You literally have rolled up shirt sleeves, so I think you're going to dive right into it.
I do. I tell you, it's been a very busy day today.
Well, can we first say, folks, if you want to support the radio station and keep miracles like this happening, please call us, 516-620-3602. We have a number of great thank you gifts that you can get if you call. Pledge any amount. We are offering the Hacker tote bags. We're offering the Hacker Digest full set. We're offering the 2600 3-year subscription, and we're also offering the Hacker portrait. We'll give you more details on those later on. But if you would just want to make the call and start the pledge process, and Kyle, you've got a Hacker tote bag right there.
Yeah, I'm actually holding it.
Hold it up to the window so the people in the street can see.
I'm pressing it against the window.
Yeah, it's
pain here.
It's glass.
I'm holding it. Yeah. So if anyone's out there and they see it,
they're pointing.
They'll know this is the famous Hacker tote bag, and I would say it's really high quality. As I'm holding it here, it doesn't feel like it's just a piece of paper. It feels like it's heavy. It's got some very heavy duty feel that just tells me that it can take all kinds of items.
That's what a bag is supposed to do.
Yeah,
this bag will not let you down.
But I wasn't sure that was clear, I wanted to make sure everyone knew.
It's not made out of straw, though, so don't get your hopes up if you think that's what we're giving away here.
No.
I mean, it's not the right season for a straw bag.
Yeah.
So.
Also, I'd quickly like to say thank you to Fun Socks on Twitter, who has confirmed for us that they can hear us from the UK. Everything's working, everything's streaming, and everything is shiny and new.
Thank you to Jens in New Jersey, who ran out through a car radio, I think, to make sure that we were on the air. It's very hard to actually confirm you're on the air lots of times, because everyone's listening through some kind of wired connection through the internet or through an in-studio link. So sometimes you might not be aware if you're actually broadcasting. It's very important in this day and age, but we are. And we're thrilled. We're thrilled to be here. All right, Alex, what do you got for us?
Well, firstly, to bounce off what Rob had said about Fun Socks, I mean, that's Zap over in London. And I have to say, when I lived over in London, I went to the 2600 meetings in London. He was the most welcoming guy, introduced me to everybody, and it's such a good crew that we have over there in London, really great, loyal listeners. wonderful meetups, and they do it in a very civilized way. You know, they meet up.
British, of course they do.
Of course. Well, I mean, they meet up in a public place, and then everything migrates to a pub, which is just, you know, I think
they're British, perfect. Of course they do.
What are you saying about that they're binge-drinking alcoholics?
Very civilized, and they're binge-drinking alcoholics. No, it's British culture.
Well, then how would you explain Brexit?
I can't explain Brexit. Right. I cannot. Listen to these airwaves. You'll get a good chance of hearing an explanation of it on these airwaves.
No doubt. But I do have to say, being in the studio is very weird. I ran in here at the last minute tonight, and I went to the other studio.
Well, we didn't tell you where we were.
No, you didn't tell me where you were. I told you I might be late. You don't respond at all.
Because we wanted you to go to the wrong studio.
I went to the wrong studio. I saw nobody in there. And I thought, what the hell happened? Am I here at the wrong hour? Did I miss it? It's been such a frazzling day.
Oh, mission accomplished. Yes. Yeah. That's exactly what we wanted you to feel.
And here we are in here. And I mean, and it's weirdly quiet in here when there's no sound.
Shh. You're right.
It's weird.
Did you hear that? Nothing.
Nothing. I mean, it reminds me of my balcony when I lived in Vermont, when you would go out there in the middle of the night and there was no sound whatsoever. And it actually hurt your ears.
What's the point of having a balcony then?
So you can see from it. I mean, you can look down on
things. You can see things not making any noise.
That's right.
All right.
Sounds
like a painting.
It sort of is very much like a painting, actually.
I'm actually getting a lot of work done. I find it it's very quiet in here.
All right. Well, yeah. I'm glad you got that term paper underway. It's about time.
No, I didn't barely notice that you were having a radio program over there.
And plus, the room is so much bigger. I think we've made it clear that this is very good for us. But I want to make sure that listeners know this is very good for them as well. You'll hear a more polished sound. We'll be able to do a lot more, and we'll just sound happier, I think, for one thing.
Well, yeah, we'll be able to focus on doing the actual radio programming.
It was so nice. There's a big green button here. It says Studio Switch. And we pressed that button, and we got control of the studio. And I realized that's the good incarnation of that. We had the bad incarnation a few weeks ago. Somebody else pressed, and I'm sure it was a red button, we pressed a green button. So we're moving ahead into 2020 and stronger than ever. I want to thank those people who made it possible and thank those of you who are even thinking of calling now. Please call. It does make a difference. This is The Living Proof. Again, 516-620-3602, or you can go to the website, give2wbai.org. Or I believe, Gila, we can also do something really newfangled by texting. Is that right?
Yes. You can text the letters WBAI to short code 41444.
And those letters have to be in order, WBAI.
I mean, yes. Although I do wonder what would happen if you could try it in all its different permutations.
Well, you might
let us know. You'd be texting for a while, I think, given all the combinatorics.
Do it after you donate.
Yes. That is very true. Can I also share the most amazing piece of fact that I learned?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay,
that's what we're all about, after all.
Yes, this is fantastic. So one of the awesome programs that exists in terms of donation is the BAI Buddy program, which helps give the station a reliable monthly stream of income.
Mm-hmm.
And once your donation total gets up to $25, you're also a member of BAI. So theoretically, check this out. A $25 donation gets you a BAI membership. You could get the Hacker Tote Bag. That's a $25 donation, right?
Absolutely.
Hang on. I got to look at my papers here. But yes, I believe you are correct. I believe that is exactly what
it is. That's fantastic. So you could pledge $25, get a Hacker Tote Bag, get a WBAI tote bag. You could double fist your way to the farmer's market. It would be amazing. But if you become a BAI buddy, we found out today that you cannot become a WBAI buddy with an American Express card.
Wait, that's a good thing?
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying it was a fascinating piece of information that I learned just before we went live in the new studio.
I wonder why that is.
I also wonder why that is. There's no explanation for it. Apparently, become a BAI buddy with Visa, MasterCard, or Discover, but not American Express.
Wait, Discover, but not American Express. I've never heard that phrase before.
I do not make the policies. Wow. I just report what I read.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll try and figure out why that is and get back to people. No, because inquiring minds want to know these things, and
absolutely.
We certainly want to know.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. It's also amazing we take Discover.
Yes. No, it absolutely is.
Also, one of our supporters here at the station, when we got here earlier, there was a supporter here dropping off a check. People
wow.
do that. People
still
drop
do
off
that.
Checks.
People to, still write checks.
To 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. And you can write a check. You can come here and bring it to us. You can mail it to us. And that is actually a very excellent way to donate to WBAI and help us keeping what we do. Or you could give us a phone pledge at 516-620-3602 or go to give2wbai.org.
or roll some pennies and just ship them here.
Yes.
Yeah, well, speaking of community-type organizations and involvement, I mean, one of the things that, if we're going to get back to the tech side of things, now that we're back on the air and we have our brand new studio and we have thanked our supporters for all of their support.
Yeah, we haven't seen you since we got the station back.
That's true.
Kyle and I were away, and you were here, and then you were away, and we were here.
That's right.
But now we're both in the same room.
Yeah, and last week, by the way, when I was sort of remote in D.C.
Yeah, with the NSA director.
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
You guys kept me on the phone so long, and I was so interested in what we were talking about that I didn't look at the time. And I literally, by seconds, made my train back to New York, which was the last train.
Wow.
And it was a comedy of errors trying to get to Union Station from the National Building Museum, literally in 6 minutes to get on the train. But thanks for that.
No problem.
I just have to say, it really was slightly stressful.
Always happy to make your evenings more interesting.
No doubt. It certainly was. There was a situation where I took a shortcut to get to the train and then realized that, oh, yes, that shortcut worked, but the escalator is going up instead of down.
Oh, that's no match for you. I've seen you go up, down escalators before.
I went down the up escalator.
And
got to the bottom of it and then realized that all that effort was for nothing because there's no way to get on the train from this side.
Ah.
There's no stairs or anything to get on the Amtrak train. But thankfully, somebody saw me in my frantic state and said, run around, I'll hold the train. And we ran up the stairs.
And that's why trains are late.
Yes, that's right. All because of you and Off the Hook and WBAI. I totally agree.
Well, I like
100%.
How we're being blamed for this. Are we supposed to give you a running time check? Is that how most people on the phone are checking, you know, to make sure they get on their trains?
I'll accept the challenge coin, something like that.
Anyway,
just hang up on us.
Yeah, I could have actually. I would have had I known what time it was. But it was it was interesting. But in any event, so speaking of public service organizations, community type organizations like WBAI, there's been a big, I guess, hullabaloo lately about the sale of .org, which is run by the Public Internet Registry.
Now, I didn't know that you could do this. Hello.
I was yelling outside.
I saw general manager. You were yelling outside, and we couldn't hear you at all. Wow. Okay. Yes, we used to hear Berthold a lot leaving the complex in our old studios. So we won't be hearing that anymore.
No.
Sorry to say. But yes, I heard this story too, that the .org top-level domain or registry is being sold or given to evil people or something? What's the story?
Well, it's hard to say because we don't know a whole hell of a lot about this new company that is ostensibly going to take over .org. I mean, and I think what's really interesting about this, too, is people may or may not know, but .org has been run by PIR, the Public Internet Registry, and that has essentially been operated by ISOC, or the Internet Society, since around 2002.
And we know them well. They help out at HOPE.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, I'm a member of the ISOC Board of Directors for the New York chapter. I do have to say I'm not extraordinarily active in it, and in all likelihood I'm not going to be seeking re-election to the board because it's not because I have any disagreements with ISOC and it's not because of what's happening right now. It's just because I don't have a tremendous amount of time to devote to that, and that's a regret of mine, in fact. But so the Internet Society was actually an outgrowth of sort of interactions and involvement in the IETF, or the Internet Engineering Task Force, which sets a lot of the technical standards for the Internet. So that was started in and around 1992 or so. And they do, various outreach type of efforts. They enhance trust in the Internet by developing certain policy frameworks for openness and trust. Connectivity is very important to ISOC, you know, on a global level, and connectivity meaning they try to enhance connectivity for places where there is none or there is little connectivity to the Internet. The goal of ISOC, I think, is very laudable, which is to have everybody who wants to be connected to the Internet in the world to be connected to the Internet. Security is really important. The rollout of encryption and encrypting the web has been an ISOC endeavor for many years. And, of course, policy development that protects and enhances the openness and stability of the Internet is also another goal of ISOC. So ISOC has done a bunch of laudable things. A lot of its efforts have been funded by operating through PIR, the Public Internet Registry, .org. However, it has just come to light within the last week or so that the ISOC, the national ISOC, not any local chapters, because I don't believe any of them were consulted about this, plans to sell .org to a newly known company. I don't know if it's necessarily a newly formed company, but Ethos Capital is the name of this particular entity. And they are essentially unlike PIR, they're not a not-for-profit, they are a for-profit investment firm interested in purchasing .org. And so this has caused quite a stir in the internet governance community because ISOC has now come under a lot of criticism for not being so open and transparent about its plans to sell .org to this other private party, which is not a not-for-profit, a for-profit entity that would then have the right to make all kinds of policy changes to the registry itself. And let me ask you a question. Do you own any .org domains? I'm sure you do.
Absolutely, yeah. So you have 2600.org for one.
Oh, you do? I didn't realize that. Okay. And it just redirects to 2600.com?
Unless there's reason to not do that, to do something else.
Well, there might be reason now. What about you guys? You guys own any .orgs?
I do have a .org in my portfolio.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people do, right? And a lot of major organizations do, and a lot of major companies do. And so people have come
EFF.org.
EFF.org is one of them. And EFF, has come out in opposition to the sale because it hasn't been as transparent and forthcoming as they would like.
ACLU.org?
ACLU.org, absolutely. Yep. So there's a tremendous amount of organizations that rely on the .org internet registry. All right. And in fact, I did some analysis on this today because we obviously work with the DNS quite a bit. So I took a look at the .org zone file. The zone file, for those of you who don't live on the command line like most of us here, is essentially a list of everything that's in an internet registry or anything that's in a list of a top-level domain. So the .com zone file would have a list of all the domains in .com. They have different formatting and whatnot, but .org, when I uncompressed it this evening before I came here, had about 25 million lines in it. That does not necessarily mean there are 25 million domains there because some records are duplicative because they have multiple name servers associated
Duplicative?
Duplicative.
That's a word?
Duplicative? Yes. You can look it up.
No, it's a great word. I just never used it.
You never used it?
Duplicative.
Sort of like swimmingly.
Okay.
Don't mean to jump in, but is that like duplicitous?
No, duplicitous would mean sort of underhanded, right?
Oh, okay.
I've used that word many times. I'm sorry. Continue.
Yeah. We can go on to semantics, too, if you want.
I hear new words, I get excited.
I know. Well, you know, you work with words, too.
I try to.
Yeah, you're a wordsmith.
Also Italian.
Oh, Italian. Okay. In any event, so .org is being sold to this company, Ethos Capital. Ethos Capital has connections to somebody by the name of Fadi Shahadi. Have you ever heard of the name Fadi Shahadi?
Is that from a cartoon?
No.
Don't mean to be disrespectful, but man, with a name like that, come on. You're going to have to get used to it. No, I've never heard that name before that I can remember.
Kyle.
Are they an influencer?
In certain small...
I knew it.
Nerdy circles.
I knew it.
Yeah. If they're an influencer, then I retract any apologies I have for making fun of the name.
Right. So Fadi Shahadi was the president and CEO of ICANN, or the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which is a not-for-profit corporation out of California that is essentially the regulatory body for the internet. They are in charge of the security and stability of the internet, and that involves a lot of the DNS policies.
Oh, nice job, guys.
Yeah.
It's been a real cakewalk lately. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it.
So they're responsible for that. All right. Good to know.
So Fadi Shahadi is an advisor to Ethos Capital. Now, Ethos Capital basically claims to be this very ethical investment firm. They claim that they've made a whole bunch of investments in other technology-related companies, and they do everything for the benefit of the internet and the stakeholders as a whole, but they haven't made any firm commitments about not increasing fees too much. They did mention that right now a .org registration is on average about $10. They plan to increase this most likely, but only to the tune of about 10% a year or $1 a year. Now, it would not be unheard of, let me tell you, since I've been working with ICANN for a number of years now, for a potential registry operator to make certain promises before there is the transfer or the delegation of a top-level domain to the root zone of the internet, meaning it goes live, and then they do something completely different. And the big problem here, and I think this is where most of the issues arise, is that ICANN itself is a very toothless regulatory body. I mean, it is a very difficult to navigate, complex organization. All operating under this not-for-profit structure. There are more acronyms than you can quite literally shake a stick at, you know, in within ICANN. I mean, you have, you know, really opaque systems like, you know, within ICANN, you obviously have the board, and then you have certain constituencies like the GNSO. Anybody know what the GNSO stands for? It stands for the Generic Name Supporting Organization. Underneath the GNSO, you have the IPC, or the Intellectual Property Constituency. You know, and you have – and the Intellectual Property Constituency is comprised mostly of lawyers who are lobbying on behalf of brand owners and copyright holders that want additional rights protection mechanisms to be put in place. So people here are thinking now that this is in the hands of a private party that wants to make money. They may enhance certain RPMs or rights protection mechanisms that could adversely affect people using .org domains for things, you know, like the hypothetical Iranian dissident who's then stifled, or people who may be using it for fair use or parody, or to make certain political statements. So there is a fear here that these private parties, much like Google and Facebook and all these other large organizations, that they may now have to kowtow to these sort of anti-democratic or autocratic regimes around the world and take certain enforcement or allow certain enforcement activities within this registry that they wouldn't – that ISOC wouldn't otherwise allow, and that ISOC would not kowtow to for the sake of having access to those particular capital markets.
So are you saying that those domains that are currently .org aren't privy to the same kinds of enforcement and regulations that a .com or a .net would be?
They certainly are. Now, they absolutely are. .org has signed on to something called the UDRP system. That stands for – it's actually another misnomer and another crazy acronym. It should be UDNRP because it stands for the Uniform Domain Name Resolution Policy, as well as the URS. I mean, this is – again, all these problems with ICANN is because everything is a damn acronym. URS stands for the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, whereby you can take down a certain number of domains, but they're not going to be transferred over to the complainant. The UDRP has been a system that's been in place for almost 20 years, since 1999, and that allows you to essentially take out domains that are infringing on intellectual property, that were registered in bad faith and are being used in bad faith. So you can certainly do that with .org, but there may be – people are hypothetically afraid of these new rights protection mechanisms that may be forced in place by certain, you know, foreign regimes. But I think a lot of where this is stemming from as well, aside from, you know, the intellectual property and free speech issues and the cost issues associated, because, you know, a dollar a year is not a huge amount of money for us in the United States, but for others around the world, it actually might be. And we have to keep that in mind as well. But I think a large part of the problem here is that this was done all behind the scenes without any of the local chapter or any of the actual ISOC member involvement. And ISOC, being a multi-stakeholder, usually transparent organization, this sort of came out of left field for many, many people. And they have a lot of questions about this. I'm very torn about this, to be honest with you, because I believe in .org. I believe in what it stands for. But, you know, I'm also realistic about it in that .org is not just used by organizations. It's used by massive amounts of private parties as well.
It used to be that you had to fulfill certain criteria to actually get a .org domain, but now anybody can get it. So I just wonder what really is changing. It seems like it's pretty much the same as any other top level like .net or .com or .anything. It's not restricted. So do most people think of .org differently?
I don't think that they do anymore. I think people realize that you can be anybody, anywhere. You can be a private party. You can be a private company. You can be, you know, a tenants organization. Anybody can get a .org domain at any time of the day. So, you know, there are no registration criteria on it anymore, much like most top-level domains on the internet. But, you know, I think you bring up a good point here, because if a private and this goes against, I think, the arguments that are opposing ISOC and what it did – is if a company like Ethos Capital is interested in purchasing the .org registry, they're going to do it on the basis of it being a good investment. And if you think, let's say, probably realistically about 10 million to 12 and a half million or so domains exist within the .org registry. That doesn't mean that all of the registration monies go directly over to the .org public internet registry right now, but it is a very valuable top-level domain. Most of the other new generic top-level domains that have come out since 2014 when ICANN launched its new GTLD program don't have nearly as many registrations as .org. So it is a way to generate a certain amount of money, and ISOC has itself been funding many of its operations through the revenue that it generates through .org. So the sale of .org has got to be for a price that would account for many years of future revenue. And if this Ethos Capital is planning on making back its investment, it has to think about things like, well, of course the revenue is based on a number of registrations. If .org is going to make – if Ethos Capital, running .org in the future, let's say the sale goes through, if they're going to make – too many changes to the registry, if they're going to increase fees, if they're going to stifle dissent, if they're going to kowtow to repressive regimes, then there's going to be a massive migration from .org because people are not going to want to be associated with it. They're not going to want to have their domains there. And there are plenty of other top-level domains where they may be able to get registrations, or they may already have registrations and they might shift to them. And if those migrations do occur because there were massive changes to the registry, then that is going to mean that the revenue is going to go down. If the revenue goes down, then the registry fails. If the registry fails, then Ethos Capital loses its investment. So from a business standpoint, I don't necessarily see the wisdom in making a massive amount of changes of the sort that people are hypothesizing would be done. Simply because something could be done doesn't mean that it makes economic sense for it to be done. That's my point there. But on the other hand, I also do feel very strongly that ISOC should come out and answer a lot of the public's questions about this.
Yeah, I mean, there's the sort of standard exercise of common sense, which is if this is under the control of a nonprofit, one would, I think, logically expect a different behavior than if it's controlled by a for-profit. And this is very interesting to me because, like, some of us in this room are old enough to remember why ICANN came into being, which was Network Solutions back in the 90s, had a monopoly on ComNet and org, and, you know, domain names cost hundreds rather than, you know, the 10 or 15 that they cost today.
Well, they used to be free.
They used to be free. Then when they became a thing to charge for, they cost a pile. And the introduction of ICANN was to break up the monopoly that Network Solutions had, allow other registrars to play, and allow competition into the field. And so how does that jive with this current way things are organized with like a single organization able to just take an entire top-level domain and do what it wants with it?
Well, you know, you raise an interesting point, but these registries we have to realize are private property. Right? I mean, if we hearken back to the heady days of 2012 when ICANN was just launching its new GTLD program, I mean, there was a massive
GTLD
run,
meaning
generic top level domain. So this is this was the expansion of the DNS or the domain name system, whereby private parties could start their own internet registries. So you could start your own equivalent of .com, and a lot of people did. When I was with my old law firm, Steptoe, we represented a number of very large organizations like Google that applied for, I think Google applied for actually 101 top-level domains. And they got a massive amount of them. They were also the only applicant to develop their own back-end registry for top-level. Most people were using
But when you say they apply, you mean domain names in the top-level domain or control of the entire top-level domain?
Control of the entire top-level domain. So, okay. For instance, .google. So, you know, there are top-level domains like .art now. You know, all of these generic terms that didn't exist on the top level, to the right of the .dot, where there was a .com, there was an application process in 2012 that allowed you to apply for whatever you wanted. Interestingly enough, nobody applied for .hack. And this is something I mentioned at
it's not really true because, first of all, I think it was like a $10,000 fee to apply and it wasn't refundable.
Oh, no. And you're getting to the point that I was about to make there, too, which most of the time you interrupt my narrative flow. Now you're actually enhancing it, which is...
We only have an hour, so we got to...
This is the new studio working out for us. But the application fee to apply for a single top-level domain, just to apply, no, not accounting, lawyers' fees, consultants, etc., was $185,000.
Okay, I saw that as $10,000 because they were both equally unreachable for me. But okay,
that's right. Yeah. So if you modify, you know, and I think ICANN had received well over 2,000 of these applications. So if you multiply 2,000 times 185,000, that's what they were all of a sudden sitting on in their bank account when the application window closed in 2013. Which is incredible.
That is incredible. How do you? That is a scam like no other I've ever heard of.
Oh, no
that
doubt.
That is incredible.
I mean, it really was amazing. I personally worked on over 200 applications for new GTLDs.
And they could just reject them all and just keep the money.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. And then some of them went to auction, and then they would pocket the money from the auctions as well. So, I mean, it was just an incredible amount of money that ICANN is still sitting on. But to go back to Rob's point is that, you know, these are private property. People pay for them, and they generate a lot of revenue. And so just like any other private property, I believe it can be bought and sold. I think ISOC should, in my opinion, personally, not as a member of ISOC or a member of the board, but my personal opinion, I think ISOC should not allow the sale to go through until it answers all the questions of all of the stakeholders in the community about what kinds of checks and balances and what kind of due diligence they have done on this company, Ethos Capital, because it's associated people with people like John Nevitt, who runs Donuts, another registry that applied for a massive amount of generic top-level domains in 2013 during that application window. I think well over 200, and they literally came out of nowhere and applied for, I think, around 200 top-level domains. And they did things like increase fees after they said they wouldn't necessarily increase fees. So they're associated with them, and they're associated with Fadi Shahadi, who's an advisor to Ethos Capital. And Fadi was an ICANN insider. He was the you know, he was in the sanctum sanctorum of ICANN. He was the president and CEO. And so it's not to say that he should be barred from having anything to do with domains or the DNS, but I think that this revolving door that seems to be revolving into lots of money has certain questions swirling around within it as well, and those questions should be answered.
Wasn't Mitt Romney's name in there somewhere?
I believe he was associated with some of the companies that have funded Ethos Capital or something. There were some Republican interests there, too.
So if we're looking at these domains as property, private property, then those of us who've been sitting on .orgs, who've owned .orgs, who've lived virtually on .orgs for, you know, years and years and years, is there any mechanism for those of us who live there to have any say, like, say, a renter would in a rental property, in what happens to them?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily at all. They have literally, I think, zero say in terms of how the registry is operated and what's going to be done with the ownership there. I think you're sort of bordering on an interesting issue here, too, is because Ethos Capital, this private company that, again, sort of came out of nowhere and wants to purchase from PIR, the .org registry, they had mentioned that they were only interested, or rather they only approached ISOC about the sale of .org in September of this year, of 2019. And that was after certain restrictions on raising rates for .org domains were lifted by ICANN. So there is definitely an interest in raising the fees if you look at the timing. However, what I think remains to be seen and is also completely unanswered is, was there any back channeling earlier on about the decision with respect to the lifting of the restrictions on fees for .org? Because that would certainly allow them to get their ducks in a row and prepare to make a bid to ISOC for the purchase of PIR on that basis. Now, here's something interesting that I found this evening, and it's one of the reasons why I rushed in here very late. And this is not conclusive, but it's a little tiny bit of digging that I did. So using the DNS intelligence platform that we use in our firm and we developed, one of the things I did was I did a scan for every single domain name that has the string Ethos Cap in it. And we found, of course, a whole bunch of them in lots of different TLDs. But a couple stuck out. Ethoscapital.com, which relates to Ethos Capital. Well, that's been around for a while. That was registered on 21 October of 2011. What's interesting to me, though, is ethoscapital.org. Ethoscapital.org was actually registered on 7 May of 2019.
Wow.
Yeah, quite interesting. Now, the registration information, the who is obviously masked, ostensibly because of GDPR, you know, the European privacy regime that prevents PII from being displayed in who is data. And who is, for those of us, again, who don't live on the command line, is, you know, how historically you would look up a domain name. Who is, you know, CNN.com will show you who owns essentially CNN.com. You can, you know, try it yourself. So the who is here is masked. But I find it extraordinarily interesting that the .org version of Ethos Capital was registered several months before they claimed to have approached PIR about this.
So you think maybe they were saying to themselves, hey, guys, we're going to pull this off. We really should have a .org ourselves.
And with somebody like Fadi Shahadi being on their advisor list, who was the president and CEO of ICANN, I would like to know, and I would like to perhaps see the communications going back and forth, if there were any, about any back-channeling of information with respect to the lifting of the registration fees on .org.
I'm also kind of surprised that that domain wasn't registered before. Most companies have squatters that take their names if they don't take them themselves. Is there a way to go back and see if it was registered before May of this year?
Oh, absolutely. I haven't done that yet, but it's quite possible that is the case. But again, this company, Ethos Capital, nobody really heard of them beforehand. I mean,
heard of Cambridge Analytica? You know, these companies just sort of pop out of nowhere.
That's true.
And you realize how evil they are.
Yeah, no doubt. But again, you know, I think Ethos Capital seems like it's trying to make the right noises to say that it's going to satisfy the stakeholders, not going to increase fees or do anything too crazy. And to an extent, I do believe them, only because the economics of making decisions otherwise would be terrible.
Yeah, all I know is Ethos is going to be pissed if they have that .org and they have to pay more for it later.
Yeah, extra dollar a year is going to kill them.
But I mean, let's see. We're going to track this. I think this is important to a lot of our listeners and important to the essentially internet users at large, and especially not-for-profit organizations. So this is really important. A lot of people are up in arms about it, and we're going to continue to track it.
Okay.
Cover it here.
We'll definitely have some updates on that. Speaking of lots of listeners, we'd like to talk to some of them. We want to test out this phone too to see if it actually works. Our number is 212-209-2887. I'm sorry. It's not on the wall. I looked on the wall and the wall's different. 212-209-2877 is our phone number. We'd just like to hear any feedback on the show, on technology in general, and other things. Let's try to keep it positive this week. We had some really amazing things happen, and we're thrilled about the advances that are taking place. So we want to keep going in that direction. And, of course, in that vein, we also would like to encourage people to call the pledge line, 516-620-3602, to show support for WBAI and make such things possible where we can improve and expand. Anything is possible. We want to hear your ideas as well. And you can write to us, OTH, at 2600.com with those ideas. Just to let you know, the pledge gifts that we have for you include the hacker portrait. That's where you can have your own likeness painted by our own Rob T. Firefly. And
yes, indeed. You can send me a photo of yourself or someone that you would like a portrait painted of, and I will interpret it artistically and paint it on a 5x7 canvas for you. This is an actual painting on natural canvas, one of a kind piece of art. You will have the only copy. And this is the only way in which you can get hold of a commissioned art piece by me, because I'm not doing this right now in outside of this premium for this station. If you go to give2wbai.org or you call 516-620-3602 and ask for the hacker portrait for a pledge of $100 or more, you could get hold of that, and I would be thrilled to do it for you.
You can also get the 3-year subscription to the printed magazine 2600, the Hacker Quarterly, for a contribution of $50. Just ask for 2600 3-year subscription, and that will come hurtling to your doorway or mailbox or a P.O. box or whatever it is that you tell them. Or you can send it to somebody else, too. It makes a great gift. or good revenge, too, at the same time. Hacker Digest, full set and lifetime subscription for a pledge of $100, a fraction of what it normally costs. So that's another great way to contribute to the radio station. And, of course, the Hacker Tote Bags that Kyle is still holding on to for a pledge of $25. And those are really cool, too. And they can hold just about anything, including all the back issues that you can get. Okay, so again, sorry, we had a bunch of phone calls come in. If you're still ringing the phone, you've gone somewhere else, and we don't know where you are. So please call us 212-209-2877. Sometimes it just sort of transfers to different lines, and they're in different rooms. Again, we just want to hear if how we sound. We don't even know if this is going to work. You might not be able to hear us on the phone. We've never used it before. Let's try this one here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Hi, go ahead. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I just sent you guys an email about a group called Save.org, and they actually have a letter posted on their website, help stop the sale of public interest registry to a private equity firm. And it's addressed, attention, Andrew Sullivan, CEO, Internet Security, John Nevitt, CEO, Public Internet Registry, Martin Botterman, Internet Corporation for Assigned Names, ICANN, and Goran Mabry, CEO of ICANN. So I think you guys maybe should try and get in touch with that group and maybe have somebody from that organization on the show or dialogue with them, you know, since they seem to be aligned with your concern about the sale of .org.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we've reviewed their letter. We've taken a look at their literature. And in fact, I have it printed out right in front of me. And the address or the domain name to get to them is save.org.org. And that's save.
Really?
Yep. Save, dotorg.org. So save.org.org. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And some of the issues that they raise, which essentially, you know, they're concerned with raising registration fees, the rights protection mechanisms, and, you know, a lot of the things that we had discussed on the air. So you're absolutely right. I think their interests are aligned, and our listeners should go to save.org.org to learn more and potentially sign the letter that they are putting together.
Thank you for that call. I'm sorry, but every time you say save.org.org, it makes me laugh. And I don't know if that's the best way to win a campaign, but it is clever. I'll give you that. It's definitely clever.
The one thing that kept coming to me is why do these registrars need to make money? I mean, I guess some of the top-level domains, sure, they could be money makers, but you're telling me, like, adding some names to a file in a DNS registry, that is, like, a huge overhead? Like, why... Why should .org be something that has to be like profit making? And you know, maybe others could, but it just to me doesn't really make sense. It sounds like the racket for certificate authorities. Honestly,
oh, yes.
Before Let's Encrypt, it's like, hey, we have this fake thing, this thing that has no tangible. It's literally a checkbox, and it means there's trust. This is the same thing. It's a line in a zone file in a DNS database somewhere. What does that cost? Like, and how can you charge enormous rates for one domain versus other domains when their overhead is the same for running those servers?
Back in the early 90s, you could register as many domain names as you wanted. It didn't cost anything. People were registering all kinds of things. And those who got there first, who didn't have a trademark violation to confront later on, they might still even own those domains now.
Yeah, I mean, Kyle, you bring up a good point. It does not necessarily have to be run in a for-profit way, but since it is private property, it can be transferred, sold, done, and that's what ISOC is doing. And one of the reasons why I went into what ISOC does for the internet at large at the outset of this discussion was to show that, you know, they're doing really important things and they have a lot of really important endeavors. And, you know, according to Vint Cerf, in an email that he wrote on November 15th, where he's sort of deflecting a lot of the criticism coming from members of ISOC, claiming that, you know, this should be ratified by the membership. It wasn't done that this deal wasn't struck in a transparent manner or in a manner in accordance with good governance principles. Vint Cerf wrote in a November 15th email that it is unrealistic to assume this deal could be negotiated in a way you have suggested. This is a good deal for ISOC, and the board deserves credit for due diligence in its negotiations. Those are the words of Vint Cerf. And I think, you know, they should carry some weight, and we should be somewhat skeptical. If it's a good deal for ISOC, that means that they're getting enough money so that they can fund their other ongoing operations that are important to all of us and important to the hacker community, important to internet users at large. But this notion that the board deserves credit for its due diligence is what I really take issue with, because we don't know what due diligence was done. We don't know what backgrounding was done on these people. Nothing about that due diligence has been transparent. And so I take issue with that. Sorry, Vint.
Yeah, I agree. Like, that goes to your point of they ought to be forthright about answering those questions, because on the surface, it looks really bad. And it, to me, as I was comparing it to the certificate authorities or other rackets in internet infrastructure, that it on the surface does not exemplify being in the public interest to have be operated by private equity interests in this particular case, not all cases, for example, .com or other stuff. But I think it's sort of a contradiction, right? Or like almost a hypocrisy.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think this is a perfect illustration of the fact that sometimes it's not what you do, but necessarily how you do it, that makes the most difference to the people to whom it matters most.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, there's some parallels between things that happened here a few weeks ago and this. It's how you do something. You know, maybe the intention was good, but the execution was terrible. So I guess we'll see how this plays out. Hey, we have a couple of other stories just like to briefly touch upon. This is kind of interesting. The Registrar General's website, Registrar General, of course, being from Zimbabwe, their website was hacked, and it was hacked by somebody who couldn't spell the word hack. That's true. The site basically had a big thing over it that said hacked, spelled correctly, and then the second one says hacked, H-E-K-E-D. The theory is that the hacker didn't know which spelling was the right one, decided to use both just to be safe. But that made news in Zimbabwe. So we like to follow things that are going on from the best domain in the world, .zw. Who owns that one, Alex?
Well, that would be Zimbabwe. That's the country code top level domain.
Yeah, but do the people of Zimbabwe own that, or is it some evil corporation there that owns that top level domain?
It's probably an amalgam of a private interest organization together with a government. I don't know exactly, but I'm sure the government has either some controlling interest in it or some say over how the registry is going to operate. But ZW is really kind of interesting, and all these country code top-level domains are really kind of interesting because they are not necessarily regulated by ICANN in the same way as the other generic top-level domains. And there's a big distinction in how disputes are reconciled in those, how domains are registered, registration criteria, you know, for .is, you know, you're going to have different fees for .zw. Some domains like .tk, which we see a lot of malicious activity originating from, give away domain names for free. So there's a huge disparity in how all of that's run.
I for one can get behind hecked as an adjective. I think it's heckin' great. I think more things should be hecked.
Okay, here's something from the Register. Apparently, ethical hacking is a redundant term, but to be a hacker is no longer a bad thing, according to proponents of the cybersecurity art form known as penetration testing. One-time LulzSec hacker Jake Davis and his deportation-proof hacker mate, Lori Love, appeared at a talk organized by pen testing business RedScan, in which the great, the good, and the Register chewed the fat about hacking for positive purposes. Davis said it's got a negative stigma because of very malicious hacking, which is always dumped into the same category of cyber attack. Davis was dismissing the term ethical hacking while embracing the old-fashioned word of hacker. We should just say hacker. To be a hacker is no longer a bad thing. You know, I take issue with that because I don't think being a hacker was ever a bad thing. And I've always been suspicious of the term ethical hacking. It just seems like a scam designed to sell you something. There's courses, there's certificates, there's kits, there's all kinds of things you can throw your money at. And if you're talking about being ripped off by hackers, well, maybe that's what they're doing, ripping off people who want to be called hackers. But it just seems like you're emphasizing the same point twice by saying ethical hacking, because hacking by default is a positive thing and is usually done by honest people.
Yeah, and I never liked the word ethical there, because ethical is kind of a neutral term. You know, if someone has ethics that somebody might say that are good, or if someone has ethics that somebody might say are negative, both of those people are behaving ethically according to their own ethical code.
Yeah, and I think that you could be a new hire for like a corporation or a government agency of sorts, for say, for instance, in the defense industry. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were you know, you fit the description of the ethical, you know, white hat. All these terms were probably thrown into the job description. And then you went about your merry way building parts for whatever bomb or whatever cog and whatever wheel you're now responsible for. That fitting a role in a job title does not necessarily beget the activity of someone who is inherently ethical. And I would argue those entities aren't necessarily just by default ethical in all scenarios.
I think we should put the word ethical in front of a bunch of different definitions of what people do. For instance, you know, politicians, that's a great place to start. So how about we define certain congresspeople, an ethical representative, for instance? You know, have that ethical governor, ethical president. Won't see that for a while. But the point is, you know, to simply define something, because what they are now is not that. You know, it's a lot more believable than hacking.
Well, for many years now, I've been going to an ethical proctologist.
Well, there you go. Yeah. See? And so, you feel better for that, don't you?
Absolutely.
All right.
Huge difference.
Well, here's something else, a late-breaking development here for those of you concerned about your Twitter accounts. Authorities have arrested an individual who is allegedly part of the Chuckling Squad. There's nothing funny about that. A hacking group that in August compromised the Twitter account of Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, according to law enforcement and criminal sources. They also claimed responsibility for hacks of other celebrities. Now, the alleged member was arrested around 2 weeks ago. One of the leaders of the Chuckling Squad goes by the handle Debug, told Motherboard this. Motherboard's not naming the individual because they're a minor. He's a member of Chuckling Squad. Well, you just divided it in half by saying he. He was a member of Chuckling Squad, but not anymore. He was an active member by providing celebrities and public figure phone numbers and helping to hack them. Okay, you know, if you take over somebody's Twitter account, is that really the same thing as a computer crime? It's a prank. It's just drawing some graffiti on a page and showing somebody they're not using proper passwords, especially the head of Twitter. When did we start treating this as if it was something serious?
Well, I think, you know, quite a few years ago, I mean, when I was growing up, doing this kind of thing would not have landed you with a federal criminal charge. Here it certainly can. It can be a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act because you accessed a system to which you didn't have without authorization, and you had no sort of privilege to access that particular system. This would be that account. And I think a lot would go into whether or not to bring criminal charges based on how the hack was done.
Right.
Here it seems like it was some kind of simjacking type of arrangement where they might have actually compromised the mobile carrier and then redirected the multi-factor authentication, the 2FA, to a separate phone and then logged into the account that way. That would be, you know, a more serious charge than just, you know, brute forcing Jack's password, so to speak.
And the thing with SIM swapping, which is the term they use here, It's linked to things like swatting threats, you know, where you have cops show up at somebody's house who is completely innocent, theft of cryptocurrency, and all kinds of other invasions of privacy. Those are the issues. Those are things that you can prosecute people for. But simply for guessing somebody's or fooling somebody into giving you a password for a Twitter account, that should never be something that is taken so seriously it involves somebody being dragged to jail.
Yeah, I mean, you always have to look at the intention behind this, too. It was the intent. Was this person motivated by private financial gain? Were they trying to sell access to the account? Were they just making a point that Twitter needs better security? If the latter, then I think there should certainly be some prosecutional discretion exercised in this case, and that's why it's important to have, you know, really good public interest lawyers who also become prosecutors too, because they're going to be handling cases just like this.
I'm really sorry for the people we didn't get to on the phone. We're just so excited by this new studio that we can't stop talking and trying other things. Kyle, one last report from the window. Anything interesting happening outside?
I just can't believe none of you saw that fire truck.
Really? That's a fire truck.
No one turned. No one looked. I looked at it. Wow. I won't even tell you what part of the show it was. It was many minutes. Is many minutes ago. No one saw the fire truck pass by.
Well, the important thing is we didn't hear it.
No. Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
But no one saw the lights. No one reacted at all. I did. But
as long as we're not on fire, yeah, it's just something that we'll just pass unnoticed from this point on. Actually, not from this point on, because this was the test drive of the new studio. We officially cut over to the new studio next weekend, I believe. Not this weekend, but the one afterwards. Okay. And there'll be all kinds of ceremonies and media coverage and things like that.
It's a ribbon cutting.
It's a ribbon cutting.
Yeah.
And there's no ribbon here yet, so it hasn't even happened.
And they're christening it.
And we have to cut back to the old studio now somehow. I don't know how that's going to happen. I think Max is going to have something to do with that.
They got to break a champagne bottle over the board.
Yeah, that's how we lost the last board.
Okay.
All right, we'll be back next week. Write to us, oth@2600.com. Tweet at us, Hacker Radio Show. And keep your eyes open for technological developments. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Good night.
Seized control back to the crappy old studio after breaking in the shining new crystal studios of WBAI New York. That's where you're tuned. That was Off the Hook live from the new studio. Well, we continue now with fundraising programs, and coming up will be Gary Null at midnight. Don't tune away, because at midnight we will be listening to a brand new episode of What's the Frequency, Kenneth, followed at 1 o'clock by Jim Freund with Science Fiction Hour of the Wolf, and Lister Live, of course, burning that flag from 3 to 5. But before all of that, some fundraising programs. Yes, help us pay for the polish to go with the new studio, as well as the rent here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, 516-620-3602. Do it in the name of Off the Hook or any other program you may enjoy here on WBAI New York.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Locally controlled, your listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station. And we're back in local control of this radio station for what I think about week 3. And we are still raising money for WBAI because I can hear our station manager in the background arranging with creditors how we're going to pay them. So this is listener-sponsored WBAI, and we are trying to raise funds for WBAI. We are joined by Gary Null. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Linda.
How's it going?
It's the anti-aging study. It's the only one other in American history of its kind.
And you did the blood test, is that correct? You did that.
Pardon me?
You did the blood test, the blood workup?
The blood workups are in. The scientists are now reviewing the blood workup, and they'll tell me yes or no. We created a whole new scientific paradigm, or we just got people healthier. One or the other, we'll find out within a week.
And most of these people in the study, they were, what, between 70 and 94 years old? Is that correct?
94 was the oldest. 95. 94, several were 80, and the majority were in their late 70s, 77 through 79.
My goodness. Have we ever tried this on younger people?
No, but I also had three younger people in to see what it would do for a younger person. One person 40, 50, and 60.
Uh-huh. Good. Yeah.
And I did it with people who had no diseases, who were vegan and healthy. Therefore, it's a greater challenge.
So they were more healthy by the time they finished, I betcha.
Well, it's all going to be in the blood workup.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's what we're looking for.
I see. And when do we get the results of that?
We got the results yesterday. The nurses finished the impedance yesterday, and we increased bone mass 2.3% to 3% in all the people, and the highest bone mass increase was in the woman who had osteoporosis, who was 94.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit about why it's so important to increase bone mass?
Well, because you frequently hear someone saying, oh, that poor person fell and broke their hip. It's just the opposite in most cases. A person has a thinning of the bone because they're not taking in the nutrients like boron and manganese and vitamin D3 and calcium magnesium from citrate and certain fatty acids in order to create new matrix. And then from that bone mass comes our B cells, our part of our immune system. And you have to exercise. You have to exercise your muscles in a certain way so that there's forced compression when you take a step, so that compression reverberates into the femur and other bones and allows them to strengthen and absorb calcium. And also your diet can demineralize you. Coffee demineralizes you because it's a highly diuretic. Soft drinks can create the same thing. Caffeine is a diuretic. And so you could be taking in some, think of the people who mistakenly take in their vitamins in the morning with coffee without even thinking about it and don't realize what that actually means for the body. So you don't want thin bones because then your bones are so thin they cannot support your larger structure and they break. And then you fall down and they say, you fell down and broke your hip. No, your hip broke, then you fell down.
And so this study that you've been conducting has actually increased bone mass.
And it reduced their body fat, especially their abdominal body fat, which reduces their chance of a heart attack.
And just for people tuning in who maybe don't know what in the world we're talking about, I'm speaking with Gary Noll. I'm Linda Perry. This is WBAI New York. And Gary's just going to briefly explain the study that he has been conducting over the past few weeks. He's going to be continuing on with this study just so that we catch you up on what he's doing.
Well, I'm going to be working for the next 4 weeks with a group that started late. They had to be on campus for 60 days. They're not allowed to go off possibly and have a fast food meal. You know, we don't want that. We want people to know that everything that they're doing, they're all doing the same. You have to have everyone following the same protocol, and then you have to have reproducibility of a protocol, meaning the results that I get, if some other scientist did the same study, they should reasonably expect to get the same results. And so we had to have medical supervision, even though it was non-medical. It's lifestyle and behavior modification only. No drugs, no diagnosing, no treating any disease. Because in my world, aging is not a disease. And yet the whole medical model says that aging is a pathology, and it's not. The diseases come from the mistakes we make in life, the foods we eat, the beverages we drink, how we deal inappropriately with stress. That's what creates disease, and behind almost all disease is inflammation. So by putting people on anti-inflammatory programs and turning off the inflammation, that reduces the attacks against your cell. You see, let's just say for argument's sake that you have 100 trillion cells. People might have, smaller people, 75 trillion, 50 trillion to 100 trillion cells. But we're just using this as an example. The science shows that you have about 10,000 gene alterations per cell every 24 hours. That means those 100 trillion cells, they're being attacked by free radicals due to oxidative stress, due to smoking, due to drinking, due to acidic foods like sugar and meat, due to overeating, excessive caloric intake, and hence obesity and weight gain, and due to the diseases that come from being overweight, like diabetes and high blood pressure, and heart disease, congestive heart failure, and arthritis. All these are due to excessive inflammation, and that's due to having a highly acidic lifestyle and not being properly de-stressed. So then that creates the actual attacks against your DNA. Now, at the DNA level, though there's about 10,000 gene alterations per cell per day, the body, when it's younger, can repair some of that damage. But the older you get, the less you can repair. Until one day, you're not repairing anything. You just keep getting more and more damaged, and it would be a death by a thousand cuts. You know, the first cut, you're going to be fine, you know, but the 10 millionth cut, you're not. You know, you bled out.
Gary.
And that's what happens. And then we make the mistake, and it's a fatal mistake. And it's based upon massive arrogance and hubris within the medical and scientific community of assuming that because everyone suffers from the same conditions, that those conditions are themselves legitimate markers of the of aging. Hence, we say that dementia is a disease of aging, and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS. That's not true. None of those are normal to the aging process. They're normal to the pathologically lifestyle deficiency input that we have. So as long as you keep doing the wrong thing, sooner or later you will manifest diseases. And then those diseases will be said to be age-related. If we start seeing Alzheimer's in 20-year-old, diseases will be said to be age-related. If we start seeing Alzheimer's in 20-year-old, then you've got a problem. Then we would notice it. If suddenly we shifted, if all of the older people in America started to suddenly change their lifestyles and get healthy, but the younger people are dying faster than any younger generation in 100 years, and it is known today that for the last 3 years, American men and women, they're reducing their lifespan. I mean, we're going backwards. For the first time in 100 years, we're going back. And that's because the diseases of affluence, the diseases of poverty. You know, you're less likely in poor neighborhoods to see organic markets. Mm-hmm. And with income disparity, you're less likely to see people who have enough disposable income to afford the type of supplements that they should have, the ability to go into safe places through walk out and do power walking.
Gary has a treat for everyone. What we're offering today, a special three things, the red stuff, green stuff, and also the muscle stuff. And we're offering the three together as a pack for listener-sponsored WBAI, for listeners to call in and to become members of WBAI by calling 516-620-3602. For a pledge of $160, you get a thank you gift of the muscle stuff, the green stuff, and the red stuff. So can you tell listeners a bit about what this is?
I invented green stuff for myself and my mother 30 years ago. In fact, it was 33 years ago. I was going on tour, and I knew that where I was, there was not going to be any healthy food I could eat. I was going out to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and nice people, not a good diet, and big on beef and potatoes and white bread. So anyhow, what I did is I had a garden down at my organic farm, and it was about 5 acres, and I just harvested everything and juiced it. And a friend of mine then said, let's dry this without heat. I said, okay. So that's what we did. We dried all these vegetables. And so when I was out on the road, I found that I could take a scoop of this throughout the day, and I just felt so much energy you couldn't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
that was terrific. And when I got back, about a month and a half later, I'm in the Institute of Fly Biology in my lab, and I felt something. I was sitting at my desk, and I was, you know, rubbing my forehead, and I suddenly felt something. I went in, and I looked in the mirror, and suddenly where I have male pattern baldness, all the men in my family do, suddenly there, I saw little hair growing. I thought, whoa, you know, I'd done everything I could to get my hair to grow, and nothing was causing it to grow. And so I thought, well, how did this happen? And the only thing I could imagine at the time was different in my life was the that powder that I made. But I had to redo the whole thing all over again because I didn't keep track of what was growing in the garden. And so I grew everything again, and again I tried it. And this time I asked some of my friends who had thinning hair to try it, and they tried it, and it worked. And then I did the largest study I've ever done. There were 1,500 people. 5,000 showed up. It took a year to see, could we reverse male and female pattern baldness in a group of people who stuck to a very specific protocol, and it worked. So that was the first thing. But then my mom, no matter how many times I would say, look, please just stop with all the bad food that you're eating. You smoke 3-pack cigarettes a day. You're drinking coffee all day. And, you know, you're eating the same old food, and it's not healthy. And she's, well, she's, you know, but I'm used to it, and, you know, and I'm